The following is a lecture on the Nectar of Devotion, Chapter Number 7, given by His Grace Sriman Sankarshan Das Adhikari, recorded on June 16th, 2009, in Canberra, Australia.
So tonight we are reading from the Nectar of Devotion, Chapter Number 7, Evidence Regarding Devotional Principles, beginning on page 65.
Nana shastra vichara naika nipano sahadharma samstapako lokanam hitakarino tribhuvane mahanyo sharanyakaro Radha Krishna Padaravinda Bhajana Nandena Mataleko Vande Rupa Sanatana Raguyugo Shijiva Gopalako.
I offer my respectful obeisances unto the six Goswamis, namely Sri Sanatan Goswami, Sri Rupa Goswami, Sri Raghunath Bhatta Goswami, Sri Raghunath Dasa Goswami, Sri Jiva Goswami, and Sri Gopal Bhatta Goswami, who are very expert in scrutinizingly studying all the revealed scriptures with the aim of establishing eternal religious principles for the benefit of all human beings. Thus they are honored all over the three worlds, and they are worth taking shelter of because they are absorbed in the mood of the gopis and are engaged in the transcendental loving service of Radha and Krishna. So tonight's topic is three items here. Not accepting unfit disciples, constructing many temples, or reading many books. Another stricture is that a person may have many disciples, but he should not act in such a way that he will be obliged to any of them for some particular action or favor. And one should not also be very enthusiastic about constructing new temples, nor should one be very enthusiastic about reading various types of books, save and except the ones which lead to the advancement of devotional service. And practically, if one very carefully reads Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, teachings of Lord Chaitanya, and this Nectar of Devotion, that will give him sufficient knowledge to understand the science of Krishna consciousness. One not read the trouble of reading other books. So I will stop and discuss the first paragraph, and then we'll move on. So one thing is to know that when this book is written, Nectar of Devotion, the Chaitanya Charitamrita had not been published yet. So it's not that Prabhupada is saying that, you know, it's not that this means you don't, that the Chaitanya Charitamrita is not to be read, or the Nectar of Instruction. These are books that Prabhupada also wrote, which would also should be read in the same spirit as the books that he lists here. And the point is, we don't need to become mundane scholars reading so many different speculators' ideas. If we simply read the Vedic literatures, especially the books that Prabhupada has given, because through his mercy we have the access to actually understand them. If we think, I will become a great Vedic scholar, you see, I will study some Sanskrit and I'll go off studying this Purana and that Purana and this Upanishad and that Upanishad, we won't be really qualified to do that, and we'll become misled. We'll think we know better than Prabhupada, who is fully self-realized, seeing Krishna face to face. You see, we think we know more than he does, and we get, well, that's another problem, you see. So the best program is to stick to the books that Prabhupada has given us and become very expert in these books. If one becomes very expert in the teachings of Srila Prabhupada, what he has given us, you become a very expert scholar in Vedic knowledge just by studying Prabhupada's books alone. There's no need to study, although Prabhupada does sometimes recommend other Vedic literatures in his purports. And those certainly can be read because Prabhupada has recommended they be read. He's recommended them as proper guidebooks, like the Manu Samhita, for example. But there's a danger also if we just go off to read, we need to read them without Prabhupada's purports. That's why we really need to stick carefully to just reading what Prabhupada has given us. And when one is very learned and expert in what Prabhupada has given, then he has recommended other books. And some of them has been translated by the BBT, like the Brihad Bhagavatamrita. That was recommended by Srila Prabhupada for our reading. So we really need to stay within the shelter of Srila Prabhupada. That's the point. And if we do that, then we will not be guilty of reading too many books. Actually, Prabhupada told us to study 24 hours a day. That was the order he gave. And he said, 24 hours doing service also. So you figure that one out. 24 hours of service and 24 hours of reading. Actually, I did figure it out. Here's how it works. Just like you're taking a chemistry course, you see. There's the lecture and the lab. Both of them are part of the course. So you're studying chemistry, whether you're in the lecture or in the laboratory. You're studying chemistry in both cases. One, you're studying it theoretically. The other, studying it practically. So in this way, the classes and our reading, that is like the lecture section of the course, and we actually do the service, that is the laboratory section of the course. So we're still studying, even if we're doing service. We're studying how this process works, you see. When you wash the dishes, you can actually study how by cleaning these dishes I'm cleaning my heart, you see. So in this way, actually, we can be studying 24 hours a day, and we can be doing service 24 hours a day. So it's not some, you know, impossible instruction, that contradictory instruction when Prabhupada said always study and always be doing service. Even when you're doing service, that's another part of your studies. You see, just like the chemistry student, he studied H2O equals water. Now he's doing it in the lab, and it's making his study more. Now he's realizing the real purport of his theoretical formula that he memorized in the lecture. You see, so in this way. So we should always be studying the books of Prabhupada and applying the teachings of Srila Prabhupada. And in this way, we'll become very, very advanced in Krishna consciousness. Now, another point is not accepting unfit disciples. See, there are injunctions, it's better not to take many disciples. But here that's saying a person may have many disciples. So that's another apparent contradiction. Actually, Prabhupada... I think he was in Montreal, yeah. Anyway, Prabhupada told the devotees in the early days of ISKCON, he said that a spiritual master who stays in one place, like stays in Vrindavan, he can have two or three disciples. But one who travels all over the, who's traveling and preaching all over the world, he should take as many disciples as possible. But now it's being said that not accepting unfit disciples, you see. In other words, some spiritual master, he may, you know, he may have, a spiritual master should not, but the Prabhupada explains there are three different spiritual masters can be Kanishta Adhikaris, Majjhima Adhikaris, Uttama Adhikaris, and we should be very careful to find a spiritual master who's an Uttama Adhikari. If someone's in like a Kanishta Adhikari, he's acting as a spiritual master, he's not really that qualified, that means he's making disciples with the motive of being a big name guru, you see. I want to have many, many disciples, so I have a big, big name, you see. And for that purpose, he accepts many people who aren't really fit. And the problem is he has to take all that karma, and then that can bring him down and cause him to fall down. And that happens sometimes, you see. Spiritual master can be very interested. Oh, I want to be big, famous name, you see. So I'll make many, many disciples. Fit or unfit, it doesn't matter. Just let me get the numbers up, you see. Then that spiritual master can fall down. you can have great difficulty. So a spiritual master should not be eager to increase the number of his disciples for his name and fame. That's a very dangerous position if a spiritual master does that. He should be thinking. There are questions later. Questions later, yeah. I'd be very happy when we get to the questions and answers session to answer. So just keep that question in your brain, and I'll be happy to answer it for you. So, but the spiritual master is eager to help people. If he can actually help somebody to become free of all anxiety and go back to God, and for that he is very eager, you see. He's interested to serve. He's not interested in reputation. That's the point. The bona fide spiritual master, his only interest is to serve, to help people to go back to home, back to Godhead. So, but if he has some motive for name and fame, you see, then he may take unqualified disciples who are not really fit, and that can cause him to eventually fall down from devotional service and become the level of being just an ordinary karmi again, at least externally, and acting like that again. Of course, Srila Prabhupada explains that any devotee who falls down, he never becomes like an ordinary karmi because he can never forget the nectar of Krishna consciousness. It's explained in a verse in the Bhagavatam that, my dear Vyasa, even though a devotee of the Lord may sometimes fall down somehow or other, he does not undergo material existence like others, fruitive workers, etc. Because a person who has once tasted the nectar of Lord Sri Krishna's lotus feet can do nothing but remember that ecstasy again and again and again and again. So, anyway, the injunction here is a very important thing. Not to accept unqualified disciples for some material means and even material purpose. That's a very important thing. And the same thing about constructing new temples. You see, just for some name, well, I'm a great spiritual master because I opened this many temples, but they're not really properly maintained, you see. That's also not good. Similar to accepting many disciples for the name and fame. Yeah, I opened many, many temples. But how's the service going on there? Well, not very well, you see. If the spiritual master can establish wonderful, wonderful devotional service in many, many temples, then he should open many, many temples where nice preaching is going on, first-class deity worship, because that will be a great blessing on this planet, which is suffering in the ignorance. Prabhupada continues here in the 7th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, 13th chapter, verse 8. Narada Muni, while discussing with Maharaj Yudhisthira the various functions of the different orders in society, especially mentions rules for the sannyasis, those persons who have renounced the material world. One who has accepted the sannyas order of life is forbidden to accept as a disciple anyone who is not fit. A sannyasi should first of all examine whether the prospective student is sincerely seeking Krishna consciousness. If he is not, he should not be accepted. In other words, some persons want a spiritual master for the sake of fashion. Just like it's fashionable to keep a dog, you see, here in the Western countries. You see, I'm very interested. You can get a registered dog. He's a registered collie, a registered beagle, you see. Pure pedigree. German shepherd. It's a very prestigious thing, you know. You have a very high pedigree dog. It's like having a Rolls Royce or a Mercedes, you see. I have a pedigree beagle, you see. Absolutely pure beagle, you see. So that's a fashion. So if one takes a guru in that way, well, you know, my guru is such and such. Yeah, he's a big famous guru. He has a long beard, you know. And he's a big famous guru, you know. And I'm great because I have a big famous guru, you see. This sort of guru accepting business is not good, you see. It's bad for the disciple and it's bad for the spiritual master. The real motive for accepting a spiritual master is one's to get free from the cycle of birth and death. It's not for name and fame, I'm going to accept a spiritual master. The spiritual master should not be motivated by name and fame, nor should the disciple be motivated by name and fame. So he should not be accepted. And then Prabhupada continues, however, Lord Chaitanya's causeless mercy is such that he advised all bona fide spiritual masters to speak about Krishna consciousness everywhere. Therefore, in the line of Lord Chaitanya, even the sannyasis can speak about Krishna consciousness everywhere. And if someone is seriously inclined to become a disciple, the sannyasi always accepts him. So, the gurus and the sannyasis of ISKCON, you see, they are traveling and preaching everywhere. And if someone really wants to try being a disciple, spiritual master will be kind upon that person. Give him a chance, you see, to become purified. The spiritual masters are very kind, and they say they take many disciples, and some of those disciples turn out not to be so fit. Becomes a big burden for the spiritual master, a headache actually. Can you imagine having to take that karma? You see. Actually, Srila Prabhupada explains that the spiritual master has to take birth again until all of his disciples go back to Godhead. Can you imagine the risk of taking disciples? It obliges the spiritual master to take birth after birth until all of his disciples are delivered back to Godhead. So it is great kindness, actually, to take someone as a disciple, because you're taking the risk of being entangled along with them in this material existence. And there's actually, Prabhupada gives a story in this connection. There was one, I'm just now forgetting the spiritual master's name. But he had a disciple who didn't make it. In Krishna consciousness. Yes, but I'm trying to remember the guru's name. Remember the guru's name? I forget the guru's name. But anyway, his disciple didn't make it. He had gotten all the way to bhava, which is one step below perfection. Almost there, you know, 99% pure. But that little tinge forced him to take birth again. And he took birth in a very rich, aristocratic family. He had all kinds of money, you see. He had all kinds of facility for sense enjoyment, and he abused it. He became, instead of getting married properly, he had a prostitute girlfriend, you see. Her name was Chintamani. And he was really keen on his girlfriend, Chintamani. One night it was raining like anything. It was storming. There was lightning and thunder, and there was flash flooding, and it was a heavy, stormy night, and he just got hit with this intense lust for Chintamani that night. So he didn't care about the thunder and the lightning and the flashlight. He just headed out. Oh, I got to be with my Chintamani tonight, you see. So he came to the river, and it was flooded. Well, how to get across? Well, I'll just grab something and float across. He grabbed something. It turned out to be a corpse, and he didn't care. A dead body, you know. Oh, who would want to touch a dead body, you know? He didn't care. He was so lusty. It's okay. Let me just get to Chintamani somehow or other, you see. He got across the river and he got to her house. There was a big wall on the gate. With a courtyard. He was banging on the gate. She couldn't hear him because of all the lightning. What to do, you know? I just got to enjoy with Chintamani. I got to enjoy, you know. Well, I'm just going to climb up the thing. He grabbed on a snake and he didn't even care, you know. But it was poisonous, it might kill him. He didn't even care. I don't care. He thought it was a vine. Oh, it's a snake. Well, I don't care. Let me just get over that wall somehow or other, you see. So he finally got in there and Chintamani was shocked. Viva Mangala, what is this? You're coming in a stormy... Are you this infatuated with blood and flesh? She was actually very... special woman, this Chintamani. I'll tell you in a minute how special she was. She was a very special woman, even though she was a prostitute. It's amazing. She actually preached to him and said, "What is this? You're this man after blood and flesh? You're crazy, Baba Manga. You should give up the material world. This is too much. You should give this up. Just go to Vrindavan and become a sadhu." You know who she was? She was his spiritual master from his previous life. Prabhupada explains, his guru had to take birth as a prostitute and have illicit sex with his own disciple, you see. Can you imagine? Just to save him. What the guru had to do to save his disciple, it was his spiritual master from a previous life. He took birth as a prostitute to save his disciple. So he preached, Chintamani preached very convincingly, and he came to his senses. Yes, yes, yes. So he headed out for Vrindavan immediately. But along the way, he saw a beautiful Shudra woman. And again, he became allured, you see. He followed her home. In those days, the Brahmins were very, very honored. So the Shudra man, he saw, well, his wife came home and a man came behind. "Oh, a Brahmin has come." Instead of thinking, "What are you doing following my wife?" He said, "Oh, please come. Please sit down. Let me feed you. How can I serve you?" In this way, all service to this Brahmin, you see. Not thinking, "Well, why did he follow my wife home?" He wasn't just, "Oh, I'm blessed by a Brahmin's presence." He said, "How can I serve him?" Bibha Mangalam. He said, "I want to enjoy your wife." He said, "Yes, you're a Brahmin. I'll give you anything you want." "Yes." So he let them be alone so he could enjoy the wife, you see. And again, Bibha Mangalam, those words of Chintamani vibrated in his heart, and again he came to his senses. He said, "Mataji, give me your hairpin." And he put out his eyes. He blinded himself on the spot. It'd be a really intense movie, you know, Hollywood movie, if they did this. This would really be an incredible movie if Hollywood ever did this one. But yeah, he put out his eyes. It was a horrible scene. He put out his eyes with that hairpin. And then he somehow got to Vrindavan as a blind man, you see. And he lived for hundreds of years in Vrindavan. He became a pure devotee of the Lord, and Krishna used to personally come and give him his association. And he's now celebrated. He lived for hundreds of years. He became a great pure devotee in Vrindavan, you see. His spiritual master had to help him by coming back again as a prostitute. So just see the risk of becoming a spiritual master. It's a very risky thing. It's not fun and games, being a spiritual master. It's very, very, very serious business. So, and then Prabhupada continues. So the one point is that without increasing the number of disciples, there is no propagation of the cult of Krishna consciousness. Therefore, sometimes even at a risk, a sannyasi in the line of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu may accept even a person who is not thoroughly fit to become a disciple. Later on, by the mercy of such a bona fide spiritual master, the disciple is gradually elevated. However, if one increases the number of disciples simply for some prestige or false honor, he will surely fall down in the matter of executing Krishna consciousness. So it's a pretty stern warning, you see. If the spiritual master is sincerely trying to help people, he can take unlimited disciples. But if there's any motive there for name and fame, he's cutting his own throat by taking those disciples. That's a fact. Similarly, a spiritual master has no business reading many books simply to show his proficiency or to get popularity by lecturing in different places. One should avoid all these things. It is also stated that a sannyasi should not be enthusiastic about constructing temples. We see in the lives of various acharyas in the line of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu that they are not very enthusiastic about constructing temples. However, if somebody comes forward to offer some service, the same reluctant acharyas will encourage the building of costly temples by such servitors. For example, Rupa Goswami was offered a favor by Maharaj Man Singh, the commander-in-chief of Emperor Akbar, and Rupa Goswami instructed him to construct a large temple for Govindaji, which cost vast amounts of money. So, A bona fide spiritual master should not personally take any responsibility for constructing temples, but if someone has money and wants to spend it in the service of Krishna, an acharya like Rupa Goswami may utilize the devotee's money to construct a nice, costly temple for the service of the Lord. Unfortunately, it happens that someone who is not fit to become a spiritual master may approach a wealthy person to contribute for temple construction. If such money is utilized by unqualified spiritual masters for living comfortably in costly temples without actually doing any preaching work, that is not acceptable. So Prabhupada is here talking about something known as an unqualified spiritual master. That means he's not really, you know, properly situated to be a spiritual master, but yet there are such people in the world who are making a business of being a spiritual master and making a lot of money at it, getting a lot of followers. But such spiritual masters, as explained in the Ishapanishad, they are going to the darkest region of ignorance, and their followers are going with the darkest region of the universe, I mean to say, and their followers are going with them. So one should be very careful to find a bona fide spiritual master who is purely representing the line of the Gaudiya Sampradaya, the Prabhupada, who is purely representing Srila Prabhupada, who is the leading exponent of the Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya. One must be very careful to find a spiritual master who is purely representing Srila Prabhupada without any material motives. And then one will be properly connected with Srila Prabhupada and the previous acharyas by serving such a spiritual master. So let's see here. In other words, a spiritual master needn't be very enthusiastic for constructing temple buildings simply in the name of so-called spiritual advancement. Rather, his first and foremost activity should be to preach. In this connection, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Goswami Maharaj recommended that a spiritual master print books. If one has money, instead of constructing costly temples, one should spend his money for the publication of authorized books in different languages for propagating the Krishna consciousness movement. So Srila Prabhupada did both. But the books were always the first consideration, you see. Temple construction was secondary. Because if you have temples and nobody's reading and following the books, the temples are just like some, you know, what is it Prabhupada say? Common mess. You know. Some place where people are together and eat and sleep. You know, free hotel kind of an atmosphere. If there's no preaching spirit, the temples are like, they become useless. They become, no, the temples can't purify the hearts if the preaching spirit is not good there, you see. It becomes a business, well, we'll do a little puja so we can collect the donations so we can eat and sleep. That's what happened, you see. If that preaching spirit isn't there, then the temples become like hell. They're no longer transcendental. They're no longer in the spiritual world. They become some mundane place for eating and sleeping. So now in our ISKCON movement, we have many temples all over the world. We have to be very, very careful to always keep that spirit of preaching and book distribution. Harinam Sankirtan, these activities, the temple is a base from which we preach, in which we go out and distribute books, we go out and do Harinam Sankirtan, do Ratayatra festivals, so many things to purify the atmosphere. That's the temple. There's a place, it's a base. It's a military base, you see, in one sense. If you have a military base and the soldiers don't go out and fight, they just eat and sleep at the base. What kind of army is it? You see, the enemy is there and they're just sitting, eating and sleeping. You see. If you have an Air Force base, that means the planes are going out on their bombing runs. You see. So the temple is a place where it's a place where the devotees get strength to go out and preach regularly. Every day, actually, they're meant to go out and preach. That is the temple. It's a place where devotees get strength to go out and do preaching work on a regular daily basis. They live to preach. They live for the sake of preaching, not for the sake of eating and sleeping. Then we can have unlimited temples. In every town and village, we can have temples if this preaching spirit is alive in the temples. So now we have a few minutes left for questions. Any questions?
One of the points that I was going to make is that I work with international law, and because I've been working for indigenous sovereignty, and to misrepresent religion in the way I was hearing you say it is also a function of genocide in that sense of things.
I'm hard of hearing, so I'm going to have somebody up close relate to me what you've said.
I'm saying...
I can't. Just let somebody else tell me. Who can tell me the best?
Put it up closer.
Sure. Or you can just come right here and tell me in this ear, and then I can hear you directly.
What I said was that I study law.
You study law?
I study a little bit of law.
Okay.
Because I work for indigenous sovereignty. And... in international law, state qualifies religion.
You studied English national law and...
In international law, state qualifies religion.
Stays? What's
state qualifies...
State.
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 State. The nation qualifies religion. This is largely because of terrorism and things like that. But you had to have nationality to religion. So state qualifies religion in international law. And the point I was making was you're coming close to the point of saying, talking about misrepresentation of religion, and to deliberately misrepresent religion would be genocide, would be a crime, international crime. So there's
we certainly accept that point. Of course, we call it. We accept that for someone. In the name of God, to exploit others—that is—that is criminal activity. Yes,
that's
we
correct.
Accept. Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Good.
There's no doubt.
So, there's, I'm very interested in the equation of both religion and international law as evolving.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that originally, now they are two separate departments, but in the Vedic culture, they were in the same department because. The Vedic scriptures, which was the basis of religion, was also the basis of law. The Manu Samhita, the original laws for mankind were given in the scriptures. So originally they were all in one department. Now it's two different departments. There's the law department and the religion department. Formerly it was all one department. So, but another point is, in this connection with this point you've raised, in the Vedic culture, it was the duty of the administrators, which in that case, in those days, that was saintly kings. It was their duty to make sure that those who were propagating religion were doing it according to scriptural codes. It was illegal to propagate religion which was not according to scriptural codes. In other words, if there was somebody who was acting as a spiritual master, but it was not qualified, the government would stop him. Because he's like a quack doctor.
Yeah, I have one more question for you.
Okay.
I come here, I have a different religion to Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not, in that sense, looking for Krishna consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking for a religious interrelationship, which is a different principle.
Okay.
And when... I was reading a little bit about Krishna. It was talking about the Krishna consciousness starting at a very high level of consciousness and not relating to a ground relation consciousness.
Ground?
What I call a ground level consciousness in that sense of things. Whereas I work from the type of principle of working from a ground level consciousness.
Well, the thing is, if one actually understands what is Krishna consciousness, then it includes everything from the ground all the way to the top.
That's good to hear.
You see?
That's good to hear.
When you actually get into it and fully comprehend it, you see it includes everything.
Right.
From the ground all the way up to the top.
So.
Yeah, everything's included.
Just
every aspect of life.
For the two religions, for me to equate the two religions, I was coming from poles apart to start, and so I was having a little difficulty. Because
the thing is, that's
gaining the higher consciousness.
That the idea of different religions also is a modern man-made conception.
Yeah.
You see, originally, of course, there can be different teachers and different traditions of teaching, but ultimately religion is one. There's one supreme being who's the source of all existence, whether you call him Krishna or Allah or Jehovah, you see. There is one supreme being who is the source of all existence, and to have a loving relationship. See, religion means to relink, religio, from Latin, you see. To reconnect or relink with that original source of existence, that supreme person. And the linking process is love. Like, how do I connect with you? If I love you, then I'm actually connecting with you. Otherwise, I'm not really connecting, you see. So to connect with that supreme person is through love. So there's actually one religion, whether you call it Christianity, Krishna consciousness, you know, Judaism. The real essence of religion, no matter what label you may want to give it, is to develop a loving relationship with that supreme person. And that's what we're teaching. We're not introducing another religion here. This is an educational institution teaching the theistic science, which is universal to all religious systems. That's what we're teaching here.
That's good, because that's what I was hoping for, the relation of God consciousness in from different perspectives.
Well, this is the Vedic perspective. The difference between the Vedic perspective and other perspectives is the Vedic perspective goes into much, much greater depth. Just like we all know snow, you see. We most of us have one word for it, snow. But an Eskimo, he has about 100 different words for snow, because he can see all the subtle distinction. So in the Vedics, the ancient sages of India, they had very, very, very deep, you know, spiritual realization. So their explanation of the theistic science goes into greater depth than you find like in the Bible, the Quran, for example. But that same realization is available to everyone. God is an equal opportunity employer. All we have to do is develop that love, whether I'm a Christian, a Hindu, a Jew, a Muslim, a Sikh, a Jain, or whatever. If I simply develop that love, then everyone has equal access. But in terms of the detailed explanation of the theistic science, the Vedas are like the unabridged dictionary. And other scriptures are like the abridged dictionary. That's the difference. And by studying them, by studying the Bible, the Quran, and the Vedic scriptures, you'll see exactly what I mean. And an interesting point is, in the Bible, Christ says, Father, no, that's the wrong verse. He says, I have more to tell you, but you're not ready to hear it yet. The book of John. There's a similar verse, not in the Quran itself, but in the Quranic literatures, there's a similar verse that there's more beyond what's in the Quran. But in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, idam vaksham, I just now forgot the Sanskrit, but he says in English, he says, I shall now reveal to you this knowledge, both phenomenal and numinous. This being known, nothing further shall remain for you to know. Gyanam vigyanam astikam manam. Again, I forgot. Gyanam teham savigyanam. Yeah, that's right. Chapter 7, text number 1, I believe. So, 7-1, yeah. So, Krishna, if you take the scriptures themselves, take the Bible, take the Bhagavad Gita, and you take the Quranic, the Islamic literatures, see what they say about themselves. Be completely objective. See what they say about themselves. The Bible says there's more beyond the Bible. The Islamic literature says there's more beyond the Islamic literature. And the Gita says this is it. It's all here. So even without any bias, just taking the scriptures, what they say about themselves, then we see that this is the most complete presentation of theistic science. And that's confirmed. If you don't have to take it on faith. You can just actually read the literatures in depth and you'll see it yourself firsthand. But it doesn't mean the others are not bona fide. It just means, you know, this is the Eskimo perspective on snow instead of the, you know, Malaysian or whatever perspective on snow. Everyone knows what snow is, but the Eskimo just has more intimate knowledge of it because he's more associated with it. So that's it's a rough analogy, but it covers the point fairly well. So, yes?
You're reading about the spiritual master not accepting unqualified disciples.
Right.
When we get involved in Krishna consciousness, we might be very enthusiastic about chanting and getting started in Krishna consciousness.
Right.
We might accept initiation,
right,
like that, but that might wear off.
Right.
And
it does oftentimes.
Yeah, so then we're, you know, the initial enthusiasm might wear off, but so then the spiritual master...
He's stuck with a burden.
He's got someone who's an unqualified disciple.
He has to try to save that person. That's his obligation. Someone has taken shelter of him, and now he's slipped away. The spiritual master has to do everything he can to try to save that person. That's his duty. He can't just say, well, he's nonsense. No, he has to try to save that person. He has to reach out and try to save him. Huh?
To stick to it your whole life. You know, you might be a young person and say, yeah, I can do this. There's no problem. I can do it.
Right. You know why that happens? It's because the new devotee, is his bhakti is rajasic. It's not sattvic. Devotional service in the mode of passion wears off. The newness wears off. It loses its taste. But if one does service, if one does bhakti in a sattvic spirit, it gets sweeter and sweeter and sweeter and never turns sour. In the beginning, it's rather difficult, but it becomes very sweet. So, the of course, we need to use our passion as youth. The trick is to engage both modes at the same time. Be very enthusiastic. At the same time, cultivate the sattvic consciousness of being very scholarly, understanding the wisdom in great depth, and to have good loving relationships with devotees. And to go deeply, deeply into the Maha Mantra meditation every day. You see, that will make one sattvic, and it'll keep you, even as the passion wears off, you'll go from the passionate happiness to the sattvic happiness. You see, so the spiritual masters themselves have to show a very strong sattvic nature. If the spiritual master is just Mr. Fired Up, and that's all the disciples see, is Mr. Fired Up. And they're all fired up disciples. That can wear out, you see, for everyone. But along with that enthusiasm, there has to be that sattvic depth of a deep philosophical understanding, strong loving relationships, and deep meditation on the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. If those things are done along with that fired up enthusiasm, those devotees will never burn out. They'll never go away. Yes.
Well, you're talking about the becoming sattvic, and really, isn't that also becoming nishta, steady? Because this is the mode of goodness that brings you to that. Because you can't really; it's very difficult to cultivate that while we've still got the anantas and the material desires. And
Are you equating this sattvic with the nishta stage?
To try and get.
You said nishta.
Yeah, as that you get better.
Yes, it's definitely. Nishta comes after anartha nivritti. So yeah, it means that I completely buy into what you're saying. In other words, the way to become sattvic is to get rid of the anarthas. That's part of it too. To be very, very keen to become free from all the anarthas, yes. If you go for nishta, you're definitely becoming very, very sattvic. Yes, right. They're very similar concepts. Becoming sattvic, yeah.
But sattvic is also sometimes in the mode of goodness, sometimes in the mode of passion, and sometimes in the...
Yes, but it means sattvic means you're in a transitionary stage on the way to pure goodness. That's what it means. The material mode of goodness, yeah, there's some... It's not pure goodness yet because you still have some ignorance and passion in there. But because you're trying to become completely pure. So that endeavor to become completely pure minimizes the influence of passion and ignorance on your consciousness, and therefore you're called sattvic at that point. That person is sattvic. His consciousness is sattvic, even though he sometimes has passion and ignorance creeping in there and doing their little number. It's their influence is very much minimized by his endeavor to achieve pure bhakti. His constant focus. Every time he chants his rounds, he's begging Krishna for pure devotional service, sincerely from his heart. Every day he's begging for pure bhakti. So a little eruptions of tamas and rajas in the middle of all that, they don't disturb his advancement because his 16 rounds is counteracting that. His sincere 16 rounds is counteracting that. Any other questions?
Bilba Mangala Thakur's story, I always understood that Chintamani was the Vatama Pradashaka Guru in that particular case.
In that lifetime she was. But she was actually, in that lifetime she was Vatama Pradashaka.
So
he was actually Diksha Guru.
Did he then take Diksha again?
I never heard that he took Diksha again. I can't say one way or the other. But I definitely found it in the Vedabase. I found it in the Vedabase one day. I bookmarked it and said, wow, this is an amazing quote. Shamalgiri was his name? Shamalgiri. Shamalgiri became Chintamani to save his disciple. It's amazing. Yeah.
Why she waited to give that instruction after so much time?
One has to be ready.
But he came in a very
tight. One has to be in the right mood to receive the instruction. Chintamani could have told him earlier when the relationship first began, but he wasn't ready to hear. She knew he wouldn't be able to take it. She had to wait. Preaching is according to time, desha kalapatra, time, place, and circumstance. Actually, I'll tell you honestly, there's many devotees I deal with that they need certain instructions. I know that I can see things they're doing wrong in their devotional service. But I can't tell them because I know they're not ready to hear it yet. I may have to wait years before I point it out to them. You see? I see people that I'm interacting with within ISKCON that I know they're doing things wrong, and I know I can't tell them because they won't be able to accept it. So I have to wait until our relationship matures to a point or a situation happens where I can explain it to them. That's just an example. And I just hold it because I know it won't be effective. It'll create disturbance. It won't be effective. It will just create a klesha, a clashing. Therefore, it's better that I just keep my... Prabhupada did the same thing. There was one disciple in the early days. I think his name is Ramananda. He came to India with Prabhupada. He had a beard. Big, big beard. Prabhupada didn't want any of his disciples to have beards. You see, he didn't like his hairs. You see, so... But Prabhupada didn't know how to tell him because he didn't want to devastate him, you know, and have him just leave Krishna consciousness over his attachment to his beard. It's described in the Lilamrita. The whole story is given in the Srila Prabhupada Lilamrita. You can read it, the details. But and Prabhupada finally found some day when there was some discussion he was having over some photograph or something, and Prabhupada then was able to use that to point out to him that he shouldn't have the beard. But Prabhupada was waiting for the right situation where he could tell the instruction in such a way the disciple could take it without being devastated by that instruction. So the spiritual masters do that, and see, any good preacher will do that. He won't just blurt things out. He'll wait for the right time and situation to tell that person where that person can actually, you know, benefit from that instruction. Understand? Yeah. Yeah.
One question not related to this topic, actually. Just for my curiosity, I was asking Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, what was the purpose behind his dancing and chanting all the time in the public? Main purpose.
What was the
purpose of dancing?
Well, his chanting and dancing was his ecstasy, the love of God. On one hand, there's the internal. Anytime you talk about Lord Chaitanya, as we studied at our benediction moon retreat just recently in Govinda Valley, which is really, I hope you all come to Govinda Valley on our next retreat in December. I'll put it on thought for the day, so you want to come. But anyway, it was a great retreat there, and we studied some. We spent a whole weekend studying the Shikshastika in depth, and at the end we came to studying the internal and external aspects of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. You see, he's actually doing both things simultaneously. So on the one hand, his internal side, it's his own ecstasy of love of God. He's actually feeling, he's in the ecstasy of separation from Krishna. He's trying to reconnect with Krishna, feeling himself separated and trying to reconnect in loving relationship with Krishna. So his dancing and ecstasy is his joy of feeling how he's becoming reunited with Krishna. You see, that's on the internal side. And externally, he's benedicting he's blessing all the conditioned souls. By his dancing, he's liberating the entire universe. And the ramifications of his dancing are still being reverberating throughout the whole universe. And by that mere dancing that he did 500 years ago in India, the entire universe will be delivered. Actually, it's a fact. By his dancing, he has liberated the entire universe. This time is separating us from actually seeing it, but the vibrations, the energy that he has unleashed by his ecstatic dancing will actually liberate the entire universe, deliver all the living entities back to home, back to Godhead. So there's two sides to his singing and dancing, chanting and dancing. The exoteric and the esoteric. And both of them are absolutely sublime. Yes?
Srila Prabhupada has said that we have to understand Krishna through Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu.
We have to
understand Krishna through Sri
Chaitanya. Yes, that's correct.
What does that mean in practical terms? Is that through chanting?
That means, it means many, many things, to be honest with you. That statement can be analyzed, and we could spend a whole book could be written to answer the many, many ways that we can understand that statement. One thing is, Lord Chaitanya is devotee, you see. So that means you have to be a devotee of Krishna. You can't be a scholar and understand Krishna. You have to follow the same line of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu by becoming a devotee. That's one understanding. The other understanding is, you cannot be directly a devotee of Krishna. You have to become a devotee of the devotee. Lord Chaitanya said, Gopi bar tu padapalayor dasa dasa nudasa. That was his instruction. So if you want to actually understand Lord Chaitanya, then you have to become a devotee of the devotee of the devotee of the devotee of Krishna. And that means you have to study his teachings. That means you should have a very clear understanding of the Shikshastakam, which is the only written teachings he gave. You must have a very, very solid understanding of Shikshastakam. Otherwise you can never be Krishna conscious. Another thing is, this is another point, that there are four Vaishnava Sampradayas. How many of them accept Lord Chaitanya? Only this good Sampradaya, you see. Of course, the intelligent persons in the other Sampradayas, they will accept Lord Chaitanya. But officially, their doctrine is not. So that means you need to come through this Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya if you really want to connect with Krishna in this Kali Yuga, you see. It's another meaning. So there's many, many meanings. Those are some of them. Well, there's yet, you must chant Hare Krishna. Can't just be a scholar or a yogi. You have to be a chanter. That's another meaning. But unless you have that mercy of Lord Chaitanya, you see. Because in this age, we are mostly so unqualified. How many of us are qualified spiritually? I mean, we're just, you know, we're a bunch of go-dasas and go-dasis, you know. Just servants of our senses. What hope do we have, you see? But what did Narottam, I think it was Narottam, he said, my dear Lord, you are patita pavana. If you examine my qualities, you will see that I am the most fallen. You see, therefore, my claim for your mercy is first. because you are the friend of the most fallen, therefore I am the first one in the line to get your mercy, you see. And that's another understanding. Because we are very, very fallen, you see. Lord Chaitanya is Patita Pavana. He is the friend of these fallen people. So we are all in the category of Jagai and Madai, more or less, you see. We're very selfish beasts in this age, you see. Grossly selfish beasts. So, therefore, we need that special mercy of Lord Chaitanya. There's another meaning. Any more meaning? That's right. Lord Chaitanya said, Lord Krishna said, if you want my mercy, here's what you got to do. Surrender. If you don't surrender, you don't get anything. Lord Chaitanya said, take it. Here's the mercy. He didn't say you had to surrender. In fact, one day, this shows you the incredible mercy and the incredible Bhakti Shakti of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He took off all alone walking in South India. So he's walking down the road in complete ecstasy, you know, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. And anybody who saw him without any qualification, you know, well, you got to take shelter first, then you got to take diksha, you got to be chanting these rounds. No qualifications at all, zero qualifications. Anybody who saw him walking down the road, they became a pure devotee instantly. Instant Mahabhagava. Just by seeing him. And then they would give up everything and just walk with him down the road. So he had all these people walking down the road who had seen him. They all joined him. And then he would come to an intersection on the road. He'd say, okay, now you go that way, and this way. He sent all of his followers going down different roads. And you know what? He was so powerful, his Shakti was so powerful that those devotees, he gave them the same Shakti that he had. And anybody who saw those Mahabhagavats walking down that other road, they became instant Mahabhagavats also, instant pure devotees. And then those people would walk down the road with those people, and then they would send them out different roads, and in this way it just went fanning out all over South India. In this way, Prabhupada explains, Lord Chaitanya delivered all of South India just by walking down the road. So we can see what is the potency of Lord Chaitanya. He made no conditions. And we see his followers were like that too. There was one follower. He said, well, I'm just going to deliver the first next person I see. He made a decision. Doesn't matter what their condition is, what their consciousness is. The next person I see, I'm going to make him a pure devotee. That person was empowered by Lord Chaitanya. And then, you know, the next person he saw? A corpse. He went to take his bath in the early morning and he saw a corpse. That corpse came to life and became a pure devotee instantly. You see. This is the power of Lord Chaitanya, you see. With no qualification, even one of his followers could turn a corpse to bring a corpse back to life and become an instant pure devotee. So anyway, Lord Chaitanya is amazing. He walked through the forest and get all the wild animals singing and dancing. Yeah.
In relation to this question, isn't that discrimination if somebody is following preaching Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu by not surrendering completely to himself? And while somebody is following Lord Krishna, whereas he seeks full surrender of the devotee, isn't that somehow a little bit discrimination?
What is it? I don't follow.
Isn't it a discrimination that someone is someone wanting to worship Krishna we have to say that Krishna needs full surrender and Lord Chaitanya is giving mercy freely. So isn't that discrimination?
Unfair, you mean? No, Lord Chaitanya's mercy is available for everyone. Krishna has come as Lord Chaitanya. What is the difficulty? The mercy is there. Why not take it? Why do you say, oh, I'm being discriminated against? Come on, the mercy is there for you too. Why not grab it? Take it.
So go through Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu first.
Someone is coming and saying, You know, whoever wants to be a millionaire, come here. I have $1 million for anybody who wants to be a millionaire. Let's say a billion, it sounds better. Anybody who wants to be a billionaire, come forward right now. Where is the discrimination? Everyone has equal opportunity. All you do is come and take the mercy. How you can say, oh, Krishna, this is not fair. Krishna is being more merciful. It's the same Krishna in his more merciful mood, that's all. Therefore, those who are highly learned, they say this Kali Yuga is the best of all the ages. Because in this age, it's very simple to become liberated. You just got to get that mercy of Lord Chaitanya, you see. Yes.
Lord Chaitanya is teaching the very, very high rasas of Krishna. And
high what?
Rasas.
Rasas, okay.
Mm-hmm. And so there's been some problem with the Sahajiya movement.
Yes, yes.
So isn't there a risk of, even though Lord Chaitanya is giving mercy, but he's teaching on such a high level,
now, if you follow the pathway, Lord Chaitanya said to become the servant of the servant of the servant. So if you will study Lord Chaitanya as he's being taught by the Goswamis and by the leading representative of the Goswamis, his Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, then you'll be okay. But if you think you want to come to your own understanding without going through the disciples of Lord Chaitanya, then you can be in problems, yeah.
Around the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, there was quite a problem with that, but even today there seems to be...
Yeah, even there's Sahajism nowadays too. In Austin we have an ashram, some sannyasi called... They say, well, our program here is Raganuga Bhakti. You know, they give you so-called instant Raganuga. I said, yeah, it's very... And they claim to be followers of Lord Chaitanya. They will say, where Lord Chaitanya said there's no hard and fast rules for chanting, they say that means that japa is, you shouldn't chant japa. I don't know how they got that concept. How when Krishna says there's no hard and fast rules for chanting, Lord Chaitanya says, they say, oh, that means that it's wrong to chant japa. I mean, we have to follow, if we follow the Sampradaya, the Goswamis, Naratam, Vishwanath, Baladev, Vijayabhushana, we follow these great Vaishnava Acharyas from the time of Lord Chaitanya, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati, Srila Prabhupada, then we'll be okay. But if we think we can jump to reading the literatures of the Goswamis without going through the representatives of the Goswamis, then we're in trouble, you see. Then we'll come to so many Sahaja type understandings of thinking we're on some high level. I mean, it becomes really grotesque, actually. We met one time a hippie girl in Alabama as we were traveling and preaching. She had a little ashram, actually. Lord Nityananda ashram she had. She went to Vrindavan, to Braj Mandal. She was in Radhakund. She went with some hippie boyfriend. They were having illicit sex like anything in Radhakund. And they met one Babaji there. He said, oh, you were such and such gopi in Krishna Leela. So she said, oh, very good. So she's meditating on what gopi she is, and she's having illicit sex with this boy. And then she went over to Vrindavan and got initiated by one of those Gaudiya sannyasis. Instant in the diksha from one of those Gaudiya sannyasis. I don't want to mention his name, but maybe you know, can figure out who I'm talking about. She was having illicit sex the night before, and she got an instant diksha. And of course, it didn't mean anything to her. She completely just forgot about it. But she was an instant diksha. So yeah, even in our Gaudiya line, after Bhakti Siddhanta, we have Sahajivism now that's going a little crazy. You see, that somebody can have illicit sex in Radhakund the night before, meditating on being such and such gopi, and the next day get initiated in Vrindavan. You see, and become a so-called Gaudiya Vaishnava. But yeah, it's those polluting influences are there. Therefore, we request everyone, please stay, as Prabhupada told us also, please stay within ISKCON for your training. please stay here. Don't go going here and there. There's so many, you know, so many things happening out there which are not proper. Sahaja Vaishnavism, you see. So many things improper going on out there. Just stay here. Read Prabhupada's books. There are other, there are Gaudiya Sannyasis who's saying that Prabhupada trained us incorrectly. This one famous one is making so many converts, so-called converts, you know, from stealing devotees from ISKCON. He says that, he points out that Prabhupada is not training us correctly. You see, now I will show you. You see, Prabhupada has given you, because you were neophyte, he gave you something that you could handle, but actually it wasn't right. But now I will show you the right way, you see, to observe Mangalarti. I will show you the correct way to offer you prasadam, that Prabhupada didn't, what he gave you is not actually correct, you see. So these are sahajas. These type of people are sahajas. They're interested in name and fame. They're not actually qualified to deliver people back to God, and because they're envious of the greatest acharya for spreading Gaudiya Vaishnavism all over the world, his divine grace, they see Bhakti Vananda Swami Prabhupada. So yeah, this sahaja influence is running rampant right now. On the internet, you can get bombarded with it. So just stick within ISKCON. That we tell all of our members, all of our students and members, just stay here. Prabhupada even said, when disciple asked him, thinking, what about all these higher rasas? You know, how are we going to develop them? Do we have to go somewhere else? He raised these doubts to Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada said, he asked Srila Prabhupada, is it true that if we simply follow your instructions and everything will be revealed, you know, in due course? And Prabhupada said, yes. Everything. If you follow strictly these instructions that Prabhupada has given and that we are repeating to you here in ISKCON, if you follow these instructions and everything will come, you'll realize your rasa with Krishna, everything will become fully realized just by following Prabhupada. You don't have to go somewhere else. That Prabhupada didn't give everything. Actually, Prabhupada mentions Swarup City even in the introduction of the Bhagavad Gita. To achieve the perfection of having your original identity turned on again, you see, that's Swarup City. It's right there in the introduction of the Gita. We shouldn't think that Prabhupada cannot give us Swarup City, that we have to go somewhere else for Swarup City. It's an offense against Srila Prabhupada to think that way. This succession, this branch of the Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya coming through Srila Prabhupada is the most powerful, potent branch of the Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya. And here you can get everything. You can realize your complete svarup, become reinstated in your eternal identity with Krishna in the spiritual world just by reading these books and following these books. Everything will come. That's a thing. Is that correct? Yes. Yeah, I know it's correct because Prabhupada said it, but I like to hear that it's correct. Others are understanding it too. So our time has run out. We have to get up for Mangalarti, some of us anyway. We encourage everyone to come tomorrow morning at 4:30 a.m. for Mangalarti, or to observe it at home. If it's too far, if you don't live close, then have it at home. As early as you can, sing their Gavastakam prayers, and then chant your rounds, and I guarantee you, you will have the best day of your entire life. Guaranteed. So we'll stop here. Nectar of Devotion, Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai.